Do the trashy pulp novels of the world have anything to offer? Are bestsellers all they're hyped up to be? The Terrible Book Club explores whether or not you really can judge a book by its cover or its ridiculous synopsis. If you've ever seen a book and thought, ugh, who's reading this? We probably are.
Hello and welcome to episode 186 of the Terrible Book Club. I'm Chris, and this is Paris.
Hello.
Hello, good evening.
We're so tired.
We're starting off so tired already. We can't burn out like this so quickly, but...
Well, the fun fact, listeners, as you probably already know, is that we've pre-recorded things, as always, but we've pre-recorded, like, real out of order this time, so... This is like the fifth episode we've recorded, which was a choice we made. I don't think it was a conscious one.
I'm here for it. I think season 9 is going to be fully chaotic, and I am happy about it. Anyway, we read books. We're reading books still here. This time, we read Butch by Jay Rain. This was recommended to us by listener Oz, who wrote to us last year saying, "Hiya, I just listened to your episode about The Wives, in which you mentioned being tired of reading the same kinds of bad books. A while ago, I read a book that, while incredibly badly written, still somehow left me feeling for the protagonist, because all the other characters are, in every sense of the word, ridiculously homophobic. It's called Butch by Jay Rain. It's a life story thus far type of book about a butch woman who constantly fights discrimination in the most cartoonish ways possible, and romances just about every woman she meets. I'm 99% sure this is just a veiled attempt at rewriting her own biography by the author. Maybe this can be a fresh bad taste for your reading palate. Best, Oz, a listener who bought that book thinking it was actually a big deal for butch culture, only to realize they had been tricked by the self-publishing author. We also wanted to make sure we didn't fuck this up too hard as a pair of straights, big ol' straights over here. We enlisted a bunch of our own as consulted to this episode. Thanks a bunch to Tris for taking this on. She has been adequately compensated in cheese and various other sundries. If this is your first time listening to the show, what we do here at the Terrible Book Club is read books that we assume will be bad based on their cover, title, summary, or some combination of the three. Sometimes, like today, we read books that our patrons, listeners, or friends, or random emails recommend. So we do the opposite of what most people do in a bookstore or while they're browsing the internet. Usually this experiment results in a disappointing read, but once in a while we end up liking the book. As for content warnings today, in addition to our usual barnyard language, today's episode includes discussion or mention of homophobia, racism, and sexual assault. Yeah, hey, the trio is all there. We got sexual assault in first thing, season 9. Hey, buddy, good to see you again.
No, it's not. It's terrible. We hate it. We hate to see it.
Yeah, you hate to see it. Yeah. Anyway, the back of the book summary reads, Mike's journey begins as a child as she begins her search for the one who will fulfill her heart's desire. We follow her through school, service in the Marines, and relationships that provide insight into our own troubled identity. Heartfelt and poignant, the original Butch books were considered cutting-edge and necessary reads. Says the back of the book, to no additional quotes or claims.
I actually hadn't read the back of the book, so that's an interesting one. All right.
Hey, Paris, why don't you give us our characters and setting and the very brief summary that I wrote up?
Yeah, and then I can start talking about season 9's cursed rubric. All right, so
new
characters and setting, we got Michelina, Mike Landetti, the extremely Italian protagonist.
I don't think she's it's a meing that hard, but
well, in the first couple chapters, we're fucking pizza pasta, and we are
it's really
up there.
The yeah, tomato like, levels are high.
Yeah, my Italian family. Anyway, Michelina, I'm not sure. Mike Landetti, she goes by Mike. That's how we're gonna refer to her throughout the rest of the book. You can forget her given first name because it doesn't matter.
It kind of sounds like a type of pasta. Like a nice Michelin.
A Michelina?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a food. It sounds like a food. What would a Michelina be? I don't know.
Like a pasta cake.
Oh, no.
It's like a lasagna. Really, it's a lasagna. It's just another way to say lasagna because that's what a pasta cake is. It's lasagna.
Yeah, you're not wrong. All right, and then Mike's friends and family, you got a mom and a dad, and then you've got, I don't know, her, like, childhood friends, and then the friends that she makes as she grows older. It's just like a little tie rack with a motor that's broken, and it just keeps going around so fast.
You don't really get a chance to, like, sit with any of them too long, so it feels like, even though clearly they're a part of the story, no one's around long enough except maybe the parents to, like, really care about.
I can't believe that I referenced a motorized tie rack instead of a carousel. That's how you know I am fucked right now.
They both spin. Any spinny object is fine.
Yeah. Point being, these characters blow by you so fast that you can't even grasp a shirt sleeve, a hair. You don't know who they are.
Tie, because they're all ties on the tie rack.
They're all ties. Mike, then Mike has many, many girlfriends. 14,
many,
in fact.
Many.
I counted. I went back and fucking counted. Because there were so many.
Girlfriend, three girlfriend, doctor girlfriend, therapist girlfriend, military girlfriend.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to keep track of them all. Anyhow, here's the summary that is basically just what it says on the back of the book, but in our words. We follow the life of Michelina Mike Landetti from early childhood experiences up through her careers in the military and information technology, including about 14 different girlfriends that are all hot for her but reject her in the end. Aside from this recurring theme, Mike endures being thrown out of her family's home at 13, since her mother can't stand the sight of her, harassment from male peers while in the military, and all the fun that comes with not fitting into the gender binary.
Now, while that seems like an incredibly brief summary for a piece of fiction, which is sort of unusual for us, I think, again, we'll get into this shortly, but it's because everything just floats by you so quickly and is never really sat with that long that it becomes hard to say, like, which is the important bit for us to highlight. So I just kind of gave a really general high-level overview for it, which I feel is appropriate.
No, it was appropriate. It's also a very short book. It was, 160 pages?
Something like that.
It's pretty... And those are generous pages because the type is pretty large and the spacing is pretty large as well. So 160... I mean, really, I would say this is maybe a 90-page endeavor. You know, it's not a lot of stuff.
Anyway, let's start easy with technical construction and layout for Butch. Which largely, I mean, I don't have many notes here at all.
No, this was, dude, no typos. This was edited. It's formatted totally normally. We are on Earth in present time. We are not swept into another distant cosmos.
Yes. And really, this should be an easy one for most books, right? This, like, we're just handing
it
to you.
It's not, though.
Right? It feels it's like we're just not. Handing people a point here, but it really is.
This definitely seemed edited. It had totally normal formatting. I actually even thought this book did something a lot of other books fail at, which was to use breaks to indicate, like, time passing or a scene change. And every time I was like, oh, that break was used correctly. You know, this book just used little squares to designate that in between chapters. And I know this, like Chris said, it sounds ridiculous, but seriously, so many books don't do that well at all. And then lastly, punctuation was fine. Sentences were sentencing. They were doing it.
I agree.
Chapters were chaptering, you know?
All the bricks were in place. Things were, you know, on top of each other and mortared correctly. We're really going to take, we already
stretch that shit like taffy. We're really going to keep going. Okay. That's true.
Anyway, again, it should be an easy one for most books. If this is your first time listening to us, you're like, why are they harping on this? Why are they wasting my time with this? It's not a waste of time. We have to give credit where it's due on things like this. I feel sometimes, especially let's say if you're in a crafty hobby, like not, I wouldn't maybe call this crafty, but in the arts or something. It's easy as a casual observer to get lost in, oh, that should just be working as it is. But oftentimes, especially when you're digging in the dirt like us, you find that it's not happening. So it's worth giving those the point. So hard one on this one, let's say.
Yeah, I'd say a hard one. Definitely seems like either the author themselves or someone they enlisted, to assist edited this, that this didn't have any glaring grammatic horrors, and that was great. So,
okay.
Hooray, a point.
Moving on to plot and characters. All right, let's get down to business here, Paris.
All right, so general coherence. Our notes are a little scattered on this, but we will try to keep things in check. So, this is fiction. But it's still supposed to be happening in like our regular world. Like, yes. I said, we're solidly on like terrestrial Earth in reality and like regular ass.
Yeah, this
fucking
isn't like sci-fi.
Going to get gas
romance
at the gas station. Yeah, like you're doing regular stuff. I think that's why Chris and I both had a little trouble with some of the things in here, because there's just a lot of stuff that really strains believability.
Right? There's like these moments where you're like, am I on Earth? Is this a dream?
Yeah. There were, we'll talk about the levels later, but this factors in. But in terms of coherence, I had trouble with the main through line of this book, which is, Mike is so cool that every girl falls for her, and she's so smart that she got like 4 military promotions for seemingly no reason, and she won the beauty pageant, and she's, she's a computer tech, and oh my god, it's not as though no bad things happen to her. There are bad things that happen, but the way that the positives are depicted are just cartoonish, which is the word that our listener used when they wrote in to request this book, and I think that's perfect, Oz. It really is cartoonish. I mean,
it's got some Mary Sue happening here in a weird way.
Yeah, it does. I mean, this definitely feels as though the author probably just sort of rewrote her own life, which is fine. I mean, it's not our favorite thing, but it's not.
I guess it's not impossible that you could have had 14 girlfriends that all kind of liked you at the start but rejected you in mostly the same way, and also that you won your beauty pageant while playing 4 instruments that were never mentioned before really well.
Okay, I was trying to figure out if we should read the beauty pageant moment during our discussion of Terrible's presence.
I do think it should be there.
Okay, all right, we can wait for that. So, yeah, there were just... I mean, it was generally coherent in that, like, most of the time we knew who was where, directionally, spatially, like that wasn't confusing or like what we were doing. But it did jump around a lot, and it didn't spend a lot of time on any one idea or section of her life. So it was somewhat jarring at times. Just sort of wild swings, between like, oh, she's really likes this girl, and then, oh, but she started hanging out with this other girl, and the other girl's pregnant, and they're, like, living in a barn, and they're like, wait, what, aren't you in the military? Like, what?
At one point, it brings up
moments like that,
Like, Leslie comes in, like, in a paragraph, like, she's, like, doing something, part of her military career, and then the next, there's a break, and it opens with Leslie moved in, the next week, and I was like, who's Leslie? Weren't you dating Barbara a minute ago?
Yeah, it this is sort of the main problem is characters, which we're going to talk about later. But just so you all know, I think general coherence was mostly maintained, but there were some points that made us a little confused. So maybe this is a 0.
I would say, yeah, so I get that especially with these things that are supposed to be coming of age or sort of memoir, even though this isn't an exact memoir since it's a work of fiction. You know, to speak of a plot sometimes is against the point when it's just sort of highlighting specific events in someone's life that illustrate some kind of through line. And so, like,
yeah, that's fair.
There's not like necessarily like a big overarching plot. There's not like the Dark Lord out there, like in your fantasy stories or what have you. Except, I guess, gender binary, the Dark Lord of gender binary out there.
The Dark Lord of fucking gender and capitalism and patriarchy, the triumvirate. Sure.
And that's definitely, I guess you could say, the antagonist that's happening here. But towards the end of the book, like really at the very end, Mike gives a little, I don't want to say speech, but there's like a paragraph where she defines what Butch is. And I guess the takeaway I'm supposed to have here is that her series of relationships and sort of the feelings of not fitting in because of how her gender is presented is the through line we're supposed to take from here. And I know this is a very tangled web about the differences between gender and sexuality and how they interact. But I just, it feels a little bit too narrow in focus when it's on only like Mike's failed relationships with these women who are like kind of like they're all hot for her, like sexually at the start. Like that is what is attracting them. All of them, every single one, you could say it's like about the like, oh, you're kind of a masculine presenting woman. I'm turned on about that. Let's have sex. And then months or weeks or maybe even a year or two down the line, they're like, actually, I can't deal with this. And that happens over and over and over again. And I just find that to be a very narrow focus about gender, like identity. Like it's not purely a sexual thing, right? Like
right. That is the thing that's a little unfortunate about this. I agree, is that we're sort of confusing like your gender identity and your sexual preference. And in this book, it's portrayed as like, I guess the thing I was unclear about was whether the other women she dated were Butch or not. I get the sense they were not.
Yes. Because to me, it was they were all femme.
Yeah. Which is also like a trope too, which is, which is a big complicated thing. But yeah. And because in the book, she is always the only one being persecuted for being Butch, for being suspected as gay just because of the way she looks. And I don't know. It's just kind of a bummer. Like, even when she eventually does meet other lesbians and, like, gets more into sort of the, you know, academic reading and, like, sort of more, cerebral pursuits of gender, she said that she met some other Butches and like didn't like them or something. I'm trying to remember exactly what happened there. But yeah, it is a little unfortunate that we don't get a whole lot except for, there's really like that one section at the end where you kind of start to feel like, oh, hey, these are things that make sense that, you know, I get why they're here. It just took too long to get there and it was too little all the way at the end. It was just,
I am not here to speak for like how people's gender identity can be defined, especially as, you know, white, straight, cis dude who, you know, just does not have to contend with the same sorts of things that just, you know, plain old regular women and all sorts of people that don't fit into that sort of binary or like even outside of that have to deal with. So I'm not going to. I'm really loath to be like, that's unrealistic. That's not how you should define things. I'm just saying, like, I feel like gender identity is more than your sexual attraction.
Yeah, of course it is. And that was
more than the relationships you have, because that's defining yourself by people outside of you. And I get that for a lot of people, that is how they define themselves. And perhaps for this particular person, for Mike, that is how they're defined. But it's not like the speech at the end, I think, even puts it that way.
No, I mean, so I agree that I also was looking for a little more. I was hoping this wasn't just going to be about like, well, I'm a lady who has sex with ladies, and it's like, yep, that's kind of all we got. But it was 1992. I don't know. In any case, this struggle for Mike to define herself, and probably by extension Jay, is super common. It's actually so common that a quote from this book is in an academic paper about defining butchness, which I read. I'm just going to read this excerpt sort of from the end of the paper. I should tell you what this paper is that I read. That would be helpful, huh? It is called G.I. Joes in Barbie Land, Recontextualizing Butch in 20th Century Lesbian Culture by Sherry A. Innes and Michelle Lloyd from Miami University, Ohio. Miami University, not Miami, Florida. And in it, they say, though definitions of butch may appear to be hopelessly divergent, our research revealed patterns in how butches are usually described. We studied a broad range of texts, including first-person accounts, lesbian literature, the theoretical statements of writers such as Judith Butler, Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, Sue Ellen Case, and Judith Roof, and the works of historians such as Lillian Faderman, Joan Nestle, Madeline Davis, and Elizabeth Lipovsky Kennedy, and found that definitions of the butch tended to fall into some configuration of the following four categories. She is a masculine woman, she is like a man, she adopts an active sexual role, and she desires femmes. Yet must a lesbian fall into all these categories to qualify as butch? At the end of the paper, they ultimately decide that butch is best defined as a woman who is naturally inclined to adopt masculine characteristics, but that those characteristics are not restricted to sexual desire, sex acts, or coupling, and are more about style, clothing, mannerisms, and carriage, sort of just like how you carry yourself. And I think that's what you and I are getting at, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we sort of intrinsically understand that someone's identity isn't only tied to who they have sex with and what kind of sex they have, right? It's more about the rest of them as a person. And I think that's what we were both sort of bummed to miss in this, because I don't know, I didn't learn anything.
I really don't feel like I gained much from this, aside from, like, unless, again, I can't say, maybe a bunch of lesbians do experience this kind of rejection by other women very commonly, but I wouldn't know. And it just, it stretches believability.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me as strange is that, like you said, you know, they're like initially seemingly every woman Mike meets is like super into her and like super hot for her. But then the rejection happens later, when I guess they, you know, after they have their sex, or in some cases just they're cuddling, they decide, like, I've gotten what I want from you. It's just Mike getting used over and over and over again. Although there are some instances where Mike is kind of a fuck, but for the most part, it's Mike who is the one who is getting used. And I don't know, it didn't, you know, and I talked to, you know, our friend about this, and she didn't seem to think that that was like a common through line in lesbian literature, the whole like getting used by, you know, by your partner or by sort of straight presenting women. So, you know, it's a thing that happens in media generally, but I don't think it's like particular to this subgenre, at least from what I can tell. In any case, to close out this identity discussion, I think it was notable, though, in the book that I was like surprised to see, but also like glad it was there. Mike is really clear that she is not a man. And I don't know, I just thought that was a good call out, since the larger society we live in, you know, the hegemony tends to equate those things as the same, right? But obviously a butch lesbian and a trans man are two very different things.
Yeah.
But anyway, I appreciated that. I was glad it was there. Yeah, so I think that's all we got for this section.
Yeah, my closing thought on this is that I understand that labels can have different feelings for people. Some people really appreciate them because it gives them a way to feel as if they belong to something when they felt sort of really outside of a lot of things.
Right.
And it can be kind of comforting to know, like, there are others like me. I'm not out here by myself, but others feel very confined by them as well. And I think I wished that I saw a little bit more of that kind of struggle happening in this book, at least a little bit more surface level. It kind of bubbles up randomly little bits here and there, like when Mike mentions that you know, she definitely doesn't want to become a man. That's sort of tangential to that. And I think it would have been improved by more rumination on how that label affects her. That's really what I wanted to say.
Yeah. Yeah. There wasn't as much introspection in this book as I think we both were hoping for. Yes. We got very little of it. In terms of like rules following, you know, does it follow rules or the expectations it sets out? I think it does pretty accurately depict the reality that queer women who, you know, quote unquote, appear butch, you know, appear more masculine, do face. I think they do face most of the world's homophobia, at least, you know, against lesbians anyway, since, you know, queer people who are more femme appearing, especially white women, are just assumed to be straight. So, you know, there's no visual marker that, you know, picks them out to larger society that might not accept them. And I think when you're a butch, you know, when you dress butch or appear butch in whatever way, if you're a, you know, a woman who's more masculine, it does impact you a lot more than it would somebody who is femme. And I think all the scenes where we see Mike being targeted for sort of not performing her gender correctly. I've known people, you know, my whole life, my best friend notably, and then many other people in my life who have been butch or just gender nonconforming. And yeah, you go out in public and they're the ones who get called rude shit all the time. And so I thought that the depiction of that in the book was really, yeah, really accurate and real.
That was a positive.
Those parts did speak to me, yeah.
In his favor, and I wish it was more of that. Not that I want like tragedy porn for that, you know,
no, right? No.
Like, you know, like, oh yeah, really show me how it's really fucking Mike up. That's not necessarily what I'm asking for. I am asking that should have been a little bit more the focus and the introspection and rumination that comes around events like that and how you define yourself.
Yeah, if anything, we got a lot of sort of Mike just kind of brushing things off, even when really traumatic shit does happen to her. Like, when she's a little kid, some of her friends sort of hold her down, try to hold her down and like take her shirt off, but she fights back and, you know, gets away. And then somebody in high school like tried to pants her or skirt her. I don't know, I guess because it was a time, it was a school where she had to wear skirts or whatever. And she always wore shorts under them. So, you know, joke was on them. And there's a much scarier scene where her friend slash crush's husband is really drunk and, you know, kind of gets in the doorway and is like, I'll fuck the gay out of you, basically, in not so many words. And Mike is just sort of like, you know, no way, you're drunk, man, or whatever, and just says like, oh, that, I don't know, she just like doesn't really deal with it. Like, we don't get her really dealing with
perhaps
anything.
The most masculine thing you could possibly do, though, right? It's just be like, I'm not gonna think about that. I'm not gonna think about that at all.
So butch, you just
is that the point that we missed of this story?
Honestly, that was a point in that short story I really loved that I read last year, Feed Them Silence by Leigh Mandello. The main character in that was a butch lesbian who her wife accused of being so butch that she was like taking on shitty cishet man traits. So maybe that is part of it. In terms of rules following, this is unrelated to what we were just discussing, but a rules thing. Time was fucked with. I never knew like how much time had passed, how old Mike was, where we were in time. It was very unclear to me. We're never given like ages for anyone. I was trying to piece together how much time had passed through the end of the book, and I honestly didn't know.
I have no idea. I can't tell you. She could be 47 or 28. Like, there's no...
Yes, that you're exactly right. I was like, is she 25? Is she 50 at this point? I do not know. So, yeah, I wish the temporal bounds were more defined. I wish we knew how old people were, what year it was, how old Mike was, more importantly. Like, we just don't get any of that. And it actually leads to some problems, because there's a point in the book where Mike meets one of her girlfriends at computer school. It's like not college. It's some kind of tech.
Beep Boop University.
Where she does,
you know.
Yeah, Beep Boop University.
Oh, wait, that's ITT Tech. Something. That's what ITT Tech is. I'm sorry.
So she goes to, you know, ITT Tech or whatever. And, she meets this girl and Diane. Sorry, I was searching for the name. She meets Diane. And, you know, they're talking about, like, oh, man, got to get a place on our own. And then they're like, huh, we both need a place on our own. Why don't we get a place together? And at that point, they're just friends. They're not dating. But then they start living together. And Diane's like, I want a husband. And so, I don't know. They just start playing house. They get all these pets, which is a weird aside in the book. And then, like, I don't know, seemingly, like, years go by.
I have zero idea.
I think a significant period of time passes, like a year or a couple of years, and somehow, like, I don't know, Diane fucks off in spectacular fashion and Mike tries to find her, and the Diane's father is like, you were living with a minor. And I was like, wasn't she in school and living by herself? How old? So, like, it just leads to problems. Like,
exactly.
I didn't even realize this person was maybe underage, because it just, you never described them.
Because this is after Mike's military career, like, lengthy military career.
I don't know, actually. I don't know if her career was
at least a couple
years.
Like, at least.
Or eight. Well, she got promoted every fucking 2 seconds, so
I think that's just
how
it was when it was the boomer times. You just get promoted for breathing.
She got promoted because her knees were swollen and she walked on them at one point.
Oh, yeah. That was a very calm moment there. She was like,
she also got promoted immediately when it was like her first week or her first day. It was her first day as a Marine. Oh, my God. It was her first day. And I don't know. The instructor's like, I don't know. Somebody was talking and they were supposed to be silent. And the instructor's like, who was talking? And Mike, you know, like, takes one for their team. And she's like, it was me, lady sir. And lady sir's like, well,
ma'am,
like,
Paris, you,
know,
you mean ma'am. I know we're tired.
No, it's lady sir. Lady sir. This is the Marines. And she's like, oh, well, Mike is your lieutenant now or whatever, like, just promoted her because she took the rap for talking on her first day. And shit like that happens constantly.
Again, it's that Mary Sue thing.
Times.
We're gonna get to this shortly. Yeah. Trust us.
So bad. Anyway, all right, let's talk about character quality. We have a serious case of corrugated characters here. Like,
I can barely differentiate these girlfriends, Paris. Barely.
Nope. Diane, Leslie, I don't know. What color's their hair? I don't know. What's their ethnicity? I don't know. How tall are they? No fucking idea. What could I take them in a fight? I don't know. Like, I don't know anything about these ladies.
Okay, out of the 14 girlfriends, I think I could take possibly Sharon because she was 8 or something. So she was probably small when that happened. I think I could take an 8-year-old.
No, Sharon wasn't 8.
I don't know. Again, I don't know what time was. They were teenagers, I think.
You're right. I don't know.
I think Barbara would fuck me up, actually. Barbara seemed like she had enough of life.
Barbara was a middle-aged woman.
Yes.
Barbara was a middle-aged woman. That's
she
all I got.
She seemed like
that.
She'd had enough of life, and she would be willing to, like, take a glass bottle to my neck if I looked at her the wrong
way.
She
was a middle-aged woman kind of hitting on a teenager, though. Let's just keep that in
perspective. Yes, exactly. So a loose cannon is what I'm saying. Like, willing to.
Yeah, not great.
Barbara, Sharon.
Are we just rating the girlfriends now, like, on levels of humanness? Okay.
Yeah, so I think, Barbara is probably the most human. Leslie coming in after that, because we kind of spend the most time interacting with Leslie and sort of the give and take between Mike and Leslie about, like, well, I don't know where this relationship is going. Can we open this up to a polycule or whatever happens later on? And then the rest of these, Mary, Joe, who's Gus? I don't remember Gus at all.
Gus, I forget Gus's given name, but she went by Gus. She was Mike's roommate when Mike was kicked out as a literal child and had to like work at a store and find and like live somewhere, and then she eventually lived with Gus, and then she and Gus kind of, I don't know, hugged it out a lot in the same bed, which was confusing. That's another thing we'll talk about.
Lauren and Lori, which one was Guitar Lady? By the way, one chapter was just called Guitar Lady, which I think is evident of like how thickly wrought these characters were, which is not at all.
A Guitar Lady, I believe, was Lauren. Sue, also very fucked up. Sue was Mike's physical therapist when Mike had got bit by a snake in Tijuana or something.
Yeah, it was some kind of snake poison. That's the one where her legs got fucked up, right?
Yeah, she was really fucked up, couldn't walk for a while, had to go to physical therapy, and the physical therapist just like straight up takes advantage of Mike's like inability to move her own body, which I found it to be fucked up. And like, I don't know how many, like, I imagine, you know, that this fucking Hippocratic Oath staff, all the snakes came alive and like killed Sue in her sleep.
No, you're definitely not supposed to do that. That's definitely, that's the whole reason we did this, is like, that's a really clear textbook case.
Grave violations. just kind of weird. Mary Jo, also fucking weird. Mary Jo is Mike's cousin, and they have like every Christmas they sort of have a fling and like pretend to be girlfriends, and Mary Jo is several years older, and I actually read about like, is this normal? Should I be concerned that this character?
That's a great Google search
on
your computer. Yeah, Paris, is making out with my cousin fine?
No, I actually read about it because the reason I looked it up and spent time on it is because this is like the third book we've read where specifically gay characters are having romantic or sexual contact with cousins, and I was like, is this just happening all the time? Like, what's going on with this? And so according to the National Center on the Sexual Behavior of Youth,
I thought you were going to say the National Center of Cousin Fuckers, but
no,
it's fine is our motto.
Sort of. Sexual exploration between siblings and cousins is normal and does not broach into abusive or concerning behavior, depending on the key factors of coercion and mutual initiation, duration, frequency, age difference, emotional response, and type of behavior. So based on that, I'd say that Mike's like Christmas affairs with her cousin were, I don't know, like, kind of borderline, because like Mary Jo was several years older, and they were like in middle, I think they were maybe elementary or middle school, or Mike was in elementary or middle school and Mary Jo was like middle or high school, and Mary Jo like tells Mike to like keep their behavior hidden, and like, you know, it just seemed a little fucked up. Again, kind of fucked up. not great. Anyway, I guess that stuff is pretty normal. So like, assuming basically the center was like, hey, if it like goes on for a really long time, if there's a big power or age difference, or if it's like behavior one person doesn't like, you know, there's like a lot of different boxes you have to check, but it can be normal in the sense that when you're a little kid, little kids do a lot of like pulling up their outfits to be like, I don't know, our parts are different. Like, that shit's totally fine. But when you get into the I want to marry you, don't tell anyone about this, like, that's
big old thumbs down.
That's not good.
Even the National Cousin Fuckers Institute is like, that's not what we're talking about. We're trying to keep it above board.
Trying to keep it above board. Anyway, there's a lot of details on that if you care. There's a lot of data out there from
Google
experts.
Everyone will love your search history.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I agree.
All right. What were we on about? We were finishing up
the plot.
Character quality. Oh boy. Yeah. There is also towards the end, this character named Anna literally just appears in a hallway in an apartment complex, like unceremoniously. And there's definitely a lot of like sort of magical indigenous person stuff happening.
Oh yeah. Oh boy. She's really like, you got to like get back with nature, not really nature, but you know, she's like, you got to let loose and relax, man.
And well, no, there's just some I honestly don't care enough to pull up the passages because it's not that important, but did strike me as concerning. Didn't love that character. So yeah, the character's just not good, not fleshed out, very flat. Have no idea who any of these people are. Who the fuck was Priscilla?
I've totally forget. I was looking at that name and I was like, who?
Yep. Don't know Janet. No idea who Janet was. Yes. I don't know. Yes.
So I'd give this one a zero. Right? Like it's not a negative one. It's not a one.
Yeah,
it's really
I'd give plot and characters. Actually, I might say would it be a hard or soft zero? Like a negative 0.5. What's that? Is that a hard zero?
I would say a soft zero because you're leaning towards another thing. If you're leaning towards another thing, it's a soft one. But if it's like definitely that's where it is, that's a hard zero.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'm okay keeping it at zero.
Okay. So moving on to moments to moments, sort of that, you know, again, just sentence to sentence. How does it feel when you're flipping through this book?
Prose and dialogue quality.
I found the prose to be fine. You know, it's again, like kind of going hand in hand with technical construction. It's not awful, but it's also not deep or eye-catching or interesting either, I would say.
Yeah, it's real basic writing. This is like stuff I'd expect for a book aimed at like sixth graders. But there were a couple moments where it was good. I'm gonna grab the book and read a passage. All right, maybe just a bit of a trigger warning on this one, because this is a passage about Mike and her dad sort of having a heart-to-heart about her being gay. The weather warmed quickly, and Mike was glad she still slept on the couch so she could catch the breeze through the living room windows. Her father spent most of his time on the road, and her mother maintained a cool distance whenever they were alone together. The word queer was only spoken one more time by her father, who came to her in the middle of the night and cried into her chest as she held him. "What did we do to make you like this? I'm sorry for whatever it was. I want my little girl back. Why are you like this? What did we do? Why are you a queer? Tell me what to do to help you get well." He cried for almost an hour while Mike silently stroked his head. She didn't have answers for him. She wondered herself what made her so attracted to women. It wasn't because of some great unrequited love for her mother. It wasn't from any sexual abuse by men. Whatever the reason, it was overpowering and all-consuming. It wasn't something to be explained or defined. It was like love itself, defiant in its strength and mystifying in its power. She wondered if her father could explain why he loved women any better than she could. Or if her mother had an answer for why she had married a man when she obviously wasn't happy with the consequences. So that was, especially that last line, I thought was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's good moments happening here and there, which is what makes it more disappointing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and when I was thinking about this and thinking like, oh man, this writing is just basic and kind of boring and not very descriptive, I was like, why is it so bad? And I was talking to, you know, our consultant for the show, and I was like, what's up with this? Like, you know, I was like, is lesbian fiction always this bad? Because I was reading about the book, and apparently lesbian coming-of-age novels are like a pretty common type of, you know, coming-of-age book, and I was like, you know, what's the deal? Have you read a lot of these? And she said, no, she doesn't read a lot of them because they usually suck, like this, because they are usually not well written, is what she said. So that stood out to me, and I was like, well, why do you think that is? And, you know, duh, idiot I am. She was like, money? You know, this is a really niche thing, and when you're working in a niche genre, this straight mainstream world doesn't have money or support for you, so it's hard to get beta readers and like help and find people even willing to edit and publish. I mean, think about it. This was published in 1992 in actual book form, right? We're not self-publishing on Amazon in 1992, and so definitely more of a struggle to create something and get it out there, which I think is a good point. I mean, that definitely contributes to why something might not be good. If the person or people making it are disadvantaged in a lot of ways, then, you know, their quality is probably going to suffer somewhat.
Yeah, totally fair point.
Yeah. Although that doesn't explain why it's so well edited. You know, it's like, it's really well edited, but not well written. So I don't know.
That's a fun, interesting wrinkle.
Yeah. I and maybe some people aren't looking for really great prose. I just personally am. I really don't like books that, I mean, I guess we can, I'm just going to open a spot and.
Yeah, give us the old Tereblo's tendril opening to where it may lie.
Cindy finished her school in 12 weeks and got orders to ship out to Camp 29 Palms. "I have something for you," she said to Mike. Micah kept her distance from everyone and acted detached with Cindy. "It's a half a St. Jude medal. I want you to wear it. If you ever need me or get in trouble, send it to me." She stood very close to Mike and put the medal on a chain, and the chain over Mike's head. Mike checked to make sure the curtain was closed. She recognized the look in Cindy's eyes and didn't want any part of it. "I'll send you mine if you send me yours," Mike said. "That's a deal," Cindy said, and kissed Mike's cheek. Electronics school got harder and harder. Being the only woman isolated Mike. Though she didn't get the same support as the men, she was determined to make it through. At first, the male Marines were put off by her. They believed the school should be for men only and felt inhibited by her presence. But the service is full of camaraderie, and it wasn't long before Mike was invited to the same parties and bars. She willingly went along. It was easy being with them, and reminded her of her days with Steve and Hank. The one thing their instructor had told them on the first day was to stay away from Tijuana, Mexico. Of course, telling them to stay away from something was an invitation to disaster. At their first chance, Mike and six male buddies hopped a bus for TJ. Ah, TJ's, where all the good treats are, all the good snacks.
Pick up those frozen mangoes.
The streets were lined with filth and strip shows and street hawkers trying to sell everything from rotten beer to their virgin sisters. Oh, boy. Come in, $1 for the best ass in town. No, senors, this way. The girls are here waiting for you. One hawker caught Mike's arm and tried to persuade her to enter his shack. Come in, please, tits and ass for sale here. Mike jerked her arm away. Sorry, I didn't realize this is the section I was reading. I'm a girl, asshole. Ah, a lesbian. Come, the girls will like you. Mike joined her friends at a more reasonable bar where they chugged beer until morning. The next day, Mike woke with a terrible headache and a swollen ankle. She couldn't remember twisting or hurting it in any way, and it didn't feel like a normal sprain. Monday, she marched to school as usual, but her foot and ankle were turning blue and the pain was excruciating. By the end of the week, her whole leg was blue, and Mike decided it was time for sick bay. You know, it's very like, da-da-da-da-da, and then this happened, and then we went here, and then
very,
this...
Yeah, very matter-of-fact, not really a ton of artfulness.
Yes.
Sometimes I don't love throwing that out, like, you know, it's not like you have to be purple and flowery and always going into, like, particular descriptions that are deep or anything. That's not what I'm saying. It is just that if most of your book reads like that, then I just get a little bored with it.
Yeah, it doesn't. I have trouble connecting with things that are so matter of fact. I need more introspection. I need more personal description, investment, thought put into it. There is another good moment towards the end of the book that I think demonstrates one of the peaks of decent writing and actually decent characterization. Strangely, there are two children in this book, and they actually feel more alive than the 14 girlfriends. Mike wore her beeper everywhere, which made it very convenient when Leslie, Amalia, or Anna wanted to reach her, or someone from women's studies needed a ride or a favor. At times, it seemed to be the busiest beeper in Buffalo. "Okay, kid, I got your beep and came home for lunch. What's up?" Amalia carefully unwrapped a messy peanut butter sandwich and placed it in front of Mike. She was 7 and on her own in the afternoon while Anna taught at the college. Mike smiled at her grown-up attitude, but was careful not to mock her or laugh at her. "I wanted to have a talk with you," Amalia said, "about some stuff at school." "Okay, whenever you're ready." Mike didn't like peanut butter, at least not without jelly, but she bit into the sandwich and tried to hide the fact that it immediately stuck to the roof of her mouth. "What's capitalism?" Mike nodded and tried to get the gooiness away from her teeth so she could talk. "Capitalism? Well, a system that helps the rich get richer by putting the workers in positions that don't pay them for their work while they produce a lot of meaningless things that break and we're all convinced we need so that we buy them with whatever money we have left after taxes. How's that? Does that make sense?" Amalia nodded. Mike was glad that she didn't have to repeat her explanation. She wasn't sure what she had said. "And what's a worker?"
A worker is someone chained to her job by need, who never gets paid what she's worth, pays the government for benefits she'll never get to use, and buys back everything other workers make so that the rich get richer. Oh, Amalia diligently chewed her own sandwich, and Mike marveled at how children's mouths seemed to be wetter or something so that peanut butter didn't stick as much.
So what's this all about, Squirt? You're not worried about capitalism, are you?
Uh-huh. I don't want to be a worker, but I don't want to be one of the rich guys with chains either. Seems like a lot to worry about when you're only 7. My mother says it's because I'm Chilean. We need to worry about stuff like this. I don't know. I just
there's a little bit of heart there. There's a little bit of
Yeah, a little bit of heart, and like I can imagine this happening. Like this felt like a very real conversation that a kid first hearing about capitalism, they're like 7 or 8 or something, and being like, trusted adult who's not my parent. What capitalism? What worker? Tell me. I need to know. And then the adult
I offer
just
you
sort
this
of like,
peanut butter sandwich. I heard that there's something to do. Yes. You know, this is the worker that I've produced with my labor. I offer to you in barter.
Well, yeah. And I also just think that Mike sort of just off the cuff doing her best and then acknowledging like, I don't even really know what I said. I thought that was a really great characterization of how any adult would feel trying to explain capitalism to a child or even to other adults at the time.
Accurate.
So there, you know, there's some moments, there's some glimmer of goodness in this. But you know, now we're going to talk about dialogue and Chris, what do you got? What do you got?
A little shadier there.
So we, you know, I did read one example there where the dialogue was good, but then there's sometimes we get abducted by aliens in this book, and the dialogue gets
like aliens do, right? Like you're just out in the middle of your field, you're trying to do the field cow and grazing and whatever, and then they'll just come by and be like, "Hey, man, it's tonight," and you're like, "Ah, shit, all right," and then you gotta go with them.
All right, I have a page marked, and I'm trying to remember which part of this. Yeah, I guess this is a good example of the sort of, I don't know, weird sort of racist way that Anna is depicted at the end of the book.
Oh, good.
So, who can take me to lunch? Anna's shortness and Chilean accent made her request almost childlike, and Mike possessed. Oh, God, that sentence coming out of my mouth was awful. All right.
You know, all Chileans are children. I don't know if you knew that. That's why it's like, because it's childian. You know? They drop the D. That's really.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I'll see how long Leslie's going to be, Mike said. Oh, well, then I'll get my coat. This is women's studies. The clock is like a man. It has no voice. What?
funny, because men can't talk in the women's studies class.
Mike peeked into the meeting and Leslie waved her away. That usually meant it would be hours before anyone escaped from the room, and everyone in the meeting was doing their usual constant snacking anyway. Come on, little woman, it's you and me. I am not so little. Mike chuckled as she politely held the door for Anna. And look at you, Anna said. You walk tall, but you're not so much taller. They drove to a nearby deli and had a strangely silent lunch. Anna seemed full of energy but stayed nervously quiet while they ate. Can you take me home? Anna asked. I live in the building you are in. You do? Mike was surprised. I've never seen you there. That's because you don't use your third eye. Your mind is too busy. I've seen you. Amalia has seen you. Amalia? My daughter. A little kid about so big with big, beautiful brown eyes and dimples? Why does everyone seem so little to you? Yes, Amalia, the one you pay special attention to each morning as you leave. But she is only 7, so forget it. Forget what? Never mind. I know, after all, I'm Chilean. ¿Quiere café? Sure. Aha! I knew it. I just knew it. Knew what? Mike could only laugh. This was one of the most apolitical and crazy conversations she'd had in a long time. You understood. I knew you would. You have Latin blood. That's why the ladies love you. What ladies? Don't kid me. You know. Know what? Jeez, what the hell? I don't even know you. You know me, and you know how to talk to the ladies, and you know Spanish. Come, I'll give you your coffee, and Amalia can see your eyes.
What is happening? What is going on?
In this conversation, this woman sort of accuses Mike of, like, hitting on her kid,
but then is like joking with her and is like, come on, you got to meet the kid more. Like, it's just fucking weird. And then just because she understood the phrase for like, do you want coffee in Spanish? That was like, she has Latin blood and the ladies love you because you've got Latin blood. Like, God, dude, the fuck? So, oh, man. So, and it's like third eye stuff. So that was, I definitely felt like I was up in the spaceship for a couple of
years. Yeah,
that's
where we get the glimpse of, you know, non-white people being a little bit mystical, like, you know, exotic.
Yeah. We should also read the graduation speech because
Mike is.
Do you remember that?
Vaguely, because like Mike also is not the valedictorian, the one that what's under valedictorian, salutatorian,
yeah.
And she gives this speech because even though she wasn't even in school, she like wasn't in school for like a year or two because she was doing a waitressing job, but she goes to school for like a month and like does all the exams good. And ends up being the salutatorian despite not actually going to the school that often?
No, she was in. Oh, you're right. Maybe she. Yeah, you're right. I guess you're right.
So she just was really good at school despite not actually doing much studying, I think.
Yeah, this is another. I mean, this is like another part of the Mike's so cool and all the girls like her and she's so smart. So anyway, she gets a GPA of 3.96 and becomes a salutatorian. And this is the speech she gives.
Okay.
Mike could hear the oohs and ahs as she made her way to the rostrum. I don't think anyone oohed and ahed in the rostrum, my dude. She didn't have a planned speech. She let the aliens flow through her, I guess. She wanted to look out at the class she had returned to and let the words just come naturally. I suppose many of you are surprised to see me standing up here. Yeah, you can say that. I'm a little surprised myself. It took passing a lot of tests, being able to remember what my teacher said, and having a lot of time to think about things.
That's how school works. You just sit there and think. After class, you go, yes.
What did my teacher say? It seems we all come to school on some kind of cloud. The same cloud we're born with. School is fun, and friends, arguments, and disappointments, ups and downs. That's just the sentence. Okay, sorry. I thought that was going somewhere. Each day, a little rain falls from that cloud until we reach our senior year. Then there's just a little tiny piece of cloud holding us up and keeping us going. Right behind that tiny cloud is the sun. It might be college. It might be marriage. Or maybe it's just a good job. Whatever it is, we try to see it, try to reach out and grab it. Some people
grab
use other people's clouds to get there. Some people fall off and keep on falling, never able to get back on the cloud or reach for that sun again. Well, I was lucky. My cloud was a little bigger than some of yours. It held a lot more tears. I almost jumped off and let myself fall as far as gravity would take me, but I was lucky. I had friends, people who cared. And all of you formed a rainbow behind me, a bridge to the sun. Did you know rainbows go to the sun? A path that may not lead me to college or marriage or even a good job, but it'll lead me somewhere. And you can bet if any of you ever need me to hold you up or give you an extra push, I'll be right there on that rainbow you gave me, and I won't let you down. Thank you. The crowd was silent except for a few sighs and some stifled sobs. So after this,
my cloud.
You know, she's like, Okay, so her last sentiment in this speech is like, if any of you ever need me, like, I'm going to be here from you. Literally immediately after her speech, she gets on a bus to South Carolina to join the Marines.
Later, fuckos.
She literally leaves from the speech where she's like, I'll help any of you. Just kidding, suckers.
Bye. Goodbye.
Bye, bitches.
Was it supposed to be a sarcastic speech?
I'll just read after. Okay, the crowd was silent except for a few sighs and stifled sobs, whatever. Mike took her diploma from the principal and walked right out of the auditorium. She could hear the applause as she left.
She left her cap and gown at the door and then made her way down Main Street, through the cemetery, up and around Newton Street, along Central Avenue, and into the Marine Corps recruitment office. 2 weeks later, Mike was on a bus to Paris Island, South Carolina. She'd stayed busy making sure she made no goodbyes. She wanted a clean break from everything and everyone. She made no promises and left no address.
I thought you so made a promise in your speech. Was that not a promise?
So I guess when she was like, I'll help you, as she just meant for those 2 weeks between then and when she got on a
listen,
bus.
Listen, as long as I'll help you with the cloud and grabbing the sun for those 2 weeks. But after that, listen, lady, I got to get out of here. So wait, the cloud, was the cloud above me or below me holding me up?
No, like we're on the cloud. Okay. We're born with it. And we're like riding on the cloud like in Mario. We're like
okay.
Riding it.
Okay, understood. Yeah. And then you cry.
But then it's also made of tears.
But the tears are my tears.
Yeah.
That are in the cloud. They don't fall out of my eyes and make the cloud bigger. They are the finite amount of tears I have that are in the cloud.
I'm unsure.
Okay. Just really trying to help clear that up, but apparently it is not.
Yeah. In terms of other linguistic stuff, my immediate impression of this book was negative because the first page, the second paragraph says, Mike was the name she preferred, and when she arrived in Fredonia, a small college town on the shores of Lake Erie, she made sure everyone called her that. Fredonia was an Indian word meaning free women, and that kind of freedom was important to Mike. I was like,
yeah, Donia, that's
no.
What women is. Fredonia.
Fredonia? I was like, that sounds like Anglo and Latin word parts, which would not be native language at all, and sure enough, Fredonia is a real place in upstate New York. And the village of Fredonia was incorporated in 1829. The area's original name was Canada Way, from the Seneca word Ganadawau, meaning among the hemlocks. The name Fredonia was coined by Samuel Latham Mitchell, coupling the English word freedom with a Latin ending. Wow, it's almost like I immediately knew what it was. But, like, this is one of those things that, and so that was my first impression in the second paragraph, and I was like,
immediately incorrect. Okay. Speaking about being immediately incorrect, I had a similar moment. Before we do that, though, because I think this is going to segue into Terriblo's presence here. Paris, we got to score moment to moment here. I think it's either a zero or a negative one for me.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give it I'm going to give it a zero. I'm going to give it a negative one. It was really hard. I didn't like it.
I agree.
I
got to give it a negative one. So we're currently sitting at a flat zero.
Hey, that's pretty good on this
show.
Yeah,
honestly, yeah. Okay. So, I think now we get into Terriblo's presence, our Dark Lord. We get to just talk about how untethered we felt here. And the immediate wrongness that you felt didn't strike me because, as we found out based on the thing that you mentioned earlier in this episode, sometimes I just take a book's word for it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, Fredonia. Donia sounds like women. So, yeah, sure. But it was later on in the book. We talked about earlier how it generally felt like the real world, but there are just some things that creep in on the margins here that make me think that the chaos levels are higher than we thought. So that was your example where you looked at something and you're like, that's not right. I bet that's not right. And you looked it up and you're like, that's not right. Later in the book, there was a moment where they quote a song. And it's like Mike and her friends are like playing the song and it writes out a verse from the song. And it's,
oh yeah, I actually think I can find it because it's like
it'll stick out. Yeah, it'll stick out.
Put your head on my shoulder, whisper in my ear, baby. No, it's not that one.
There's a lot of like quoted songs here and there, but there's one that is we gotta get out of this place.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we do, we got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you.
Yes. It is quoted, I believe the line after that or before, is as a Rolling Stones song.
It says, Mike changed the record to the Rolling Stones, and they all sang as loud as they could, and then there's the lyrics that I just read.
That's the Animals. That's not the Rolling Stones. That is wrong as fuck.
I didn't catch that because I don't really care about, I don't know.
A year ago, I taught the bass part to that song to a boomer bass student of mine. And so I just remember reading all the lyrics and being like, wow, the 60s sure had lame-o lyrics. Anyway, I was thought, okay, maybe like the Stones covered it because back then in the 60s, you know, maybe that's like an maybe it's an old blues song that they all stole from someone else or something. So I was like, maybe there's some like alternate version or something. I could find zero references to this song being performed by the Rolling Stones ever at all. It's the Animals. Now, all I'm saying
That's pretty weird. Like, so we found two very basic fact checks that just didn't happen.
Later in the book, there is a moment where Mike is being framed for something in military service where there was like a letter slipped under a doorway. And
the typewritten letter.
I think Mike actually does typewrite a letter. And it slipped under a doorway. And then.
Yeah, Mike does. Yep.
There's like an investigation because honestly, they're just trying to not frame her, but just sort of trump up some charges so she doesn't get the job that she wants.
They just want to kick her out because they think she's gay, because being gay in the military at that time was a problem, I guess. And it was very, very frowned upon, and it was one of those things where you could be charged with sodomy, which was classified as any quote unquote unnatural sexual act, so anything that wasn't heterosexual sex. And that could get you a dishonorable discharge. So
You got it. Anywho, letter is discovered, and Mike is like, they'll never figure out it was me because I typed that letter with only my two index fingers.
Yeah, I can read it to you, this small section. Mike went straight to her office and pounded on her typewriter. She used only two fingers, but she could hammer out a letter almost as fast as a trained typist. Dear Lauren, why are you doing this? I cared about you. In some ways, I still do. Turning people in for every damn little thing is not going to get you anywhere. Why don't we jam together sometime and stop all this investigation crap? Signed, you know who. She slipped the note under Lauren's door and went into the lounge to shoot pool. Just as she was sinking the eight ball, the investigating officers tramped through the lounge on their way to Mike's office. The raging lieutenant waved Mike's note to Lauren like a flag. We've got you now, you little pervert. Now we have proof. All we have to do is match the type in this letter to your typewriter and you're done. Mike laughed to herself as she racked the balls for a new game. The letters would only match if they could type with two fingers. Though her office door was closed, she could hear the clacking typewriter and rising voices. Eventually, the dejected officers filed out and marched through the lounge without a glance. Eight ball in the corner pocket, Mike said. End of chapter.
Okay, now I understand perhaps we, you know, grew up after typewriters a thing. Perhaps the force with which you press a key might impact how the ink hits the paper. And
unless everyone in the barracks had different models of typewriter, how would you know it wasn't, like, I can't imagine the military had multiple different kinds of typewriters, right?
Yeah, so, like, I really don't understand, but write in and explain to us, you typewriter people. This sounds like an Antiques Freaks email ask more than a terrible book club one. But,
yeah, Antiques Freaks, help us out here. We need your typewriter crime enthusiasts. Tell us. We need typewriter forensics.
Okay, so stuff like this and the whole Mary Sue-ness where Mike is just generally – everyone's clapping for Mike, right? Like everything that happens here sounds like – and then Albert Einstein stood up and clapped and was like, that's some good roadhead, boy. Call back to a previous episode.
Oh, yeah. So this is the point where we should read the pageant scene, because that pageant scene was where I felt the most unglued from reality. And it was pretty early in the book. And I was like, I read it over and over again and I couldn't figure out what happened.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And this is where I have a theory that I would like to posit after you read this one, Paris.
Okay. The other context is that Mike had done no preparation did not announce to anyone what her skit was going to be for the pageant. She did, you know, all the rest of the swimsuit and the prom gown and whatever. But for the talent portion, she didn't know what she was going to do. And she had to work till an hour before the pageant. The talent competition was next. Two girls sang, one twirled a baton, another danced, one play acted a scene from Macbeth. As Mike needed more stage than anyone else, it was easiest to have her go on last. She borrowed a guitar from the music room and took her seat in front of the curtain. The spotlight came on, but she could still make out Gus and the rest of the TKO girls in the front row. She strummed and thought, and then let something inside take over. I am an island alone, amidst the great waters of people. But now and then, a small wave of friendship laps up onto the shore. The song was going beautifully, but Mike felt it was time for something else. She pretended to break a string on the guitar. The audience gasped, but Mike held back her smile. She plucked the string again and watched her friends cover their faces. She had them. Now she could go on. That something like this happened, a surprise it's surely not. It all depends on what you have and what you haven't got. She continued her rhyme soliloquy as she walked gingerly across the stage and motioned for the attendant to raise the curtain. She heard the audience breathe again as they realized her joke. She smiled back at them with a punch in her eyes. Approaching the drums first, she played a portion of Wipeout. When the audience became involved in the beat, she flipped a drumstick behind her as if it had broken. Continuing her rhyme, she moved to the saxophone. When a mellow "Strangers on the Shore" poured over the crowd, they applauded. Barbara jumped up and down in the wings, then Mike made a horrible sound on the saxophone. This time, the crowd laughed. They knew it was planned. Her last rhyme took her to the clarinet. She began, "When the Saints Go Marching In," and the pit band joined her as she danced across the stage. The lighting crew joined her and added to the finale by flickering the colored lights. The whole auditorium rose in thunderous applause. The band did a replay, and everyone, especially the TKO girls, clapped and stomped their feet. When Mike finished, the crowd called her back three times. Barbara cried, Gus cried, and Mike smiled. What happened?
That was more ridiculous.
What was the joke? What was the act? What was... What? She was talking about rhyming soliloquies and she's playing instruments? Like, what the fuck?
And then you bust out Wipeout. Paris, listen, as a lifelong guitarist, how do you pretend to break a string?
You'd have to break it.
Like, there's some no kind pretending. Of like weird visual it. Sleight of hand, light refraction?
I don't know. What was the joke? Do you know?
I don't know what the joke was. Okay, you know, right into no DBC. Idea. Please explain where the joke was in there. Okay, so prior to this, there is never any mention of Mike practicing any musical instrument, never mind four different ones.
No, we had no idea that Mike sang, played guitar, saxophone, drums, anything. No idea. It's not brought up at all. And it only comes up one more time when she plays guitar with a girl in order to date her. I mean,
that was the let's jam the again thing in that letter that she wrote.
Lauren. Yeah.
Okay. So, but like it literally ends with like everyone stood up and clapped and it was the greatest thing ever. I got to ask. Okay. So here's my theory, Paris. Huh. Mike is not a reliable narrator. Now, I'm not going to be like, it's all in her head or something, but it's just like, this isn't a story to be believed at all, because this is the essence of, I think, my problem, and I think probably your problem with it, is that that kind of thing keeps happening all the time, like the eight ball in the corner pocket thing, like, it's just like, and Mike wins again, and Mike is really good at this thing that was never brought up again, and like, it's an extreme, like, the one of the most Mary Sue characters we've ever seen, perhaps. Oddly enough.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. So, I don't know. If anyone can tell me what happened in that talent competition, I'll give you a prize. I will send you a TBC book and bookmarks and, I don't know, a smooch on a piece of paper. I'll type you a letter with just two of my fingers.
I'll do that, too. I'll smooch the other side.
Yeah. We get double spooch from TBC. So then there's like a lot of little things too. I mean, we sort of devolved into mentioning some things a little earlier, so I won't repeat them.
Like that one thing isn't Tariblo's presence, but like all of this stuff bunched up together.
Thank
like
you.
Forms the atoms of the tendril. Where, like, you know, it's like, you know, when you're up really close to when you're looking at something really close, it just looks like something. But then you step back and you see the tendril rising and you're like, oh, God. And then you look at it again and it's gone. You're like, what's that? Wait, is it me? Like, I don't understand.
Do you remember the civilian intelligence part? I think someone's trying to recruit Mike for the CIA and she says no. And then that's why they decide they're going to frame her for being gay. And I was like, why do you care? Also, why would you ask someone you think is gay to be in the CIA? Because at that time, anyone in the government being gay was like a cause for immediate firing, because the idea was that other foreign powers could use that against you to blackmail you. So you couldn't. So if you were in this, they wouldn't invite openly gay people into the CIA.
This is one of the more Mary Sue things where it's like, you're like, cool enough to be in the CIA. No, I don't want to be in the CIA. Well, fuck you. We're going to ruin your life. Like, yes. Then you wouldn't ask in the first.
No. Yeah. That whole thing was bizarre as well. I think at that point I said, I am in the far reaches of the desert.
I don't know. So like,
Let's just hit some of these other weird things. Tariblo's chaos. Let's get the full tentacle array here. There's a point where, I remember who Priscilla is now after this note I just read. There, you know, speaking of like weird chaotic things, Mike meets Priscilla. Priscilla's also in the military, but is very well closeted because she's like tall and femme and doesn't talk about being gay at work or something. But out of work, she's a big gay lady. And she and Mike start dating. And this is like the first time they meet. Mike is talking to her, and then they need to go. Priscilla needs to go to the bathroom, and she leaves the stall door open and pees while like staring at Mike. And I was like, is this some kind of like
probably
dominance move? Like, is this how you hit on someone? It didn't make any sense. I don't know. It was very odd.
Have you ever peed with the door open and stared at someone?
Like, hard style while peeing?
That's a question I really want emails about. Thanks, Paris.
Hard style peeing.
I stared on people while I'm peeing all the time. It's the only way I can pee.
This is how you hit on someone.
I'm the opposite of a shy peer. I'm a very overly friendly peer.
You need an audience. You have a full studio audience. You need the sign,
everybody,
the applause
claps.
Sign blaring in your eyes. Yeah. I think earlier we mentioned there was some bizarre confusion about Diane, one of the many girlfriends at some point, being a minor. And we were like, when? What? How would that make sense? So another weird thing about Diane is that when Diane and Mike are living together, Mike is working for, is it IBM? I think it's IBM. I forget. Big computer place. Yeah, IBM. And they're living together. And Diane, while they're living together, they adopted a pet every other month. And all the cats and dogs would come inside when called and line up in chronological order. And I was like, what, the pets know their ages? The pets know the order in which they were adopted? What do you...
Yeah, chronological
way,
is a weird way to put it. I suppose if you train them well enough, they would kind of know to do it in a certain order. But it doesn't seem like they were really high-quality pet trainers or anything.
But, like, the cats lined up in chronological order. What do you mean? If they're all strays, you probably don't really know how old they are. The cats don't know how old they are. It was just very strange. I don't know. It just
they lined up in the order that they got there.
Like,
chronologically. Like, into the room. No, into the room in that very moment. Like, so Paris, if you walk into a room and then I walk into the room after you, we've lined up in chronological order.
Well, no, it no. This
well, sure, no, but like, what else? So you, we walk, we both walk outside, and you stand in a place, and I stand behind you. We've walked into the, we've walked outside in chronological order, and then when someone, the third person comes out the door and stands next to us, they've also lined up to us in chronological. It's actually very easy to line up in chronological order.
Well, you know, regardless of what order she got the cats to line up into, a few pages, just a mere two pages later, Diana's
chronologically,
murdering all of the animals.
This is important. Are they in chronological order or not? Well, yes, because she murdered the first one, and then she murdered the second one, and then she murdered the third one, which is all in chronology. She did not violate causality as she murdered the animal.
I think one... one cat got away, but the neighbor rescued one cat, so... That's how quickly we are in and out of these relationships in this book. Why would Diane be murdering all the pets? Like, it just... Not, what? Made no sense. There is randomly this lady, Janet, that is in another like, concerning power dynamic relationship in this book. Mike has a teacher named Janet, and he and the teacher sort of start hanging out. And the teacher has a son who has... Well, they thought he had some sort of developmental issues, you know, and they come to find out, Mike figures out that the son is actually allergic to clay and the father is a potter and he's just allergic to the potting clay. That was another, like, and then everyone clapped because, of course, Mike cured
was
this
able
child
to deduce
of,
and
of
cure the child
thinking problems. Very strange. I thought that was weird. I actually looked that up because I was like, can you be allergic to clay? Like, I mean, technically I know you can be allergic to anything, but this seemed particularly uncommon. I have never heard of anyone being allergic to clay. Yes, but the real, like, people that are usually allergic to clay are just, like, topically allergic to it, where, you know, they just, like, get a rash if clay touches them. It's not usually a big deal. But the real problem with clay allergies is actually clay that gets moldy. Something about the mold that lives in clay or that can develop in clay can really fuck you up. It's like really bad to be like inhaling.
If that was the case, then everyone
spores.
Around
so,
the kid's dad should have been, the kid's dad especially should have been getting fucked up.
Yeah, well, children are more sensitive to stuff like that, you know, being smaller and just having less physical mass and less having their, you know, their minds actually not be developed enough. But you're right. It is odd that the father wasn't experiencing any.
If it was supposedly this clay mold thing instead of just like a topical clay allergy, in that case, keep the kid away from the. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense based on what we know.
Yeah, no, it was definitely the mold thing because it was like cognitive issues. So
how do we score Tariblo's presence? It feels mildly chaotic.
Oh, Tariblo is here. Yeah, it does feel like I'm like leaning. I don't know. I'm leaning towards
like a positive
one. But I'm unsure. This should be a zero. Yeah, like a zero.
Yeah, to
one.
Be clear, a negative
one
is when there is a heavy chaos presence. One is like everything's normal
strong.
And fine, and
okay.
Zero is the midway. Again,
yeah,
yeah, zero. We're
zero.
Still at a
maybe
flat
zero
here. So now we get into
all
the
right.
final, honestly, probably our speediest category, should this exist. And I'm going to say this might be a zero, too, because it's hard for me to say.
Okay, so I actually come out with a yes, this should exist for a lot of reasons. And it's not because it's particularly good, but it is, I think this should exist because, you know, when you consider all the categories we have here, do you feel as if the author's goal was met? Like, yeah, I think the author met her goal. Like, she wanted to write a book about butch identity.
I could agree.
And in 1992, guess what? Wasn't a lot of that. It's 2024, and there's not a lot of that. You know, I mean... It is a very underrepresented perspective, and so the fact that we have anything out here for it is something, you know.
I can agree.
I
can actually back that up. Yeah.
Does it add anything new, interesting, or novel? Yeah. Again, for the reason I just stated, like, literature and media overall does not give butch lesbians a starring role almost ever. Like, I know that sort of lesbian coming-of-age books became a cliche, but butch lesbian stuff that centers butchness is not popular. And the reason for that is because, well, I mean, you can guess a lot of the reasons, but in short, the reason is that, you know, lesbian stuff is already niche, right? But lesbian stuff with femme lesbians can still be appropriated by the larger culture because, you know, straight men find it sexually desirable. They can imagine inserting themselves in that situation, pun unintended. You know, but butch lesbian media, not as popular because it doesn't play into, you know, the mass mainstream media's ideas about desire and like what like femme lesbians should be and what women should be like. So because butch women push against not only, you know, sexual convention, but also gender convention and conformity, it really just gets knocked into the nether regions of the niche of the niche, right? This is like a sub basement. It's like a sub basement to the subgenre. So, you know, I think for that reason, yeah, I think this is important.
I think you make a good point, and that kind of brings me around to like, yeah, I'd give this a one on should this exist, because it's just like, you're right, there's not a lot of this type of media featuring this type of person or character. So
yeah, and it didn't end with Mike dead or straight, which is how almost all lesbian media ends, as I was told
that's
by our
terrible
consultant. And
that's just terrible.
I don't know, Chris, that if you know this, but if you consume any kind of media that contains lesbians, they're almost always going to die or be turned straight by the end.
Terrible fates, really.
Yeah, not great. So, it, you know, it didn't end with that, so that's like an improvement.
Sure.
On-
Good on you for not doing the thing that it feels obvious to not do. All right.
Yeah, pretty rough out there for lesbians, especially butch lesbians. Let's see, our other questions are, did it take something from us?
No,
it was really short. Yeah. I didn't like it, but like, it didn't hurt me actively in any way, so that's fine. Would readers of the genre enjoy this? I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know who would really enjoy this. I really just think that basic ass, like, I walked over here and then I took Newton Street and then I got on the bus to fucking Tijuana, like, that really basic writing style does it a disservice.
I agree.
It doesn't invite the reader in, doesn't make anything particularly compelling, with the exception of a few small parts, one of which we've read. You know, and I just, like, it's really unfortunate to hear from, you know, the person we consulted for this episode and other people I know who are, you know, varying shades of queer, that a lot of this, like, lesbian fiction stuff is just not well done, and it is a bummer. Yeah, I don't know. I think this book is very dated, right? Like, it's from 1992. We forgot to talk about the racist shit in it. We talked a little bit about the whole, like, magical Chilean lady. There's also a couple moments. There's literally a point where Mike says, "I'm not afraid of black power or white pride." And I was like,
cool. Really cool.
Oh, a lot of equivocation.
That's a really 90s
like,
white person take on it right there.
Yeah. Early 90s, too. I'm sure this was, like, written in the 80s, right? So, you know, it's dated. It's got some kind of unfortunate... There's, like, some racist Native American shit in here, too. It's not great. Mm. But, you know, I think that this book butched so we could... I don't know. Whatever came after this.
Turbo
Did anything
Butch.
Come after this?
Hyper Butch. Super Saiyan level two Butch.
No. Rob Halford turbo lovered, so Jay Rain could Butch.
Yeah, okay. There
I
you
guess.
Go. There you go.
And then hopefully we get something. Nah, turbo lover's great, though. Yeah, I actually don't know. I was trying to do some research into, like, you know, what's popular now for butch lesbian books, and like, this shit did not pick up steam.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it's out there, but there are so many Reddit posts for people being like, "God damn it, all lesbian fiction is, you know, is for like femmes. I want butch stuff." So whoever's out there, someone, please write some Butch stuff that's got some good prose. Please. Nice, rich descriptions, introspection in the characters.
It's so dry out there. The desert is never ending.
It can't all be about finger banging the chick you met at the bar. There's like so much of that in this book. God. It can't all be about having really questionable relationships with your cousin, physical therapist, and your teachers and bosses.
Please give us anything. Anything else, please.
Please. I can't bear another leg humping scene.
Honestly, even in straight media, please, I could use less of that.
No, you're right. We complain about this stuff with cishet, straight cishet stuff all the time. We don't want it anywhere. But anyway, I think this book served a purpose, you know, and I don't think it's good. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, even friends I know who are Butch or queer in some way.
But I guess still a one on this?
For the show this exists, yeah.
Okay.
It sneaks
so
out
of
one.
So we have a grand score, grand total of 1 out of 5.
I think that's acceptable.
Yeah.
Considering the possibilities are -5 through 5.
Yes.
That's fine.
Exactly. So congrats to Butch for being as down the middle as possible to start off the rubric. I feel like there's a good testing of the rubric. That feels right.
This book... Look, we're at the end of the episode. I feel like I've earned the right to say this book sucked. It wasn't very good.
I love it, man.
It's got a lot of like historical importance for, you know, gay subcultures and stuff for butches out there. But like, man, I just hope now I feel like I'm just going to like be on the warpath to be like, somebody needs to write good butch stuff. Somebody, please. I feel bad.
Well, I guess the Feed Them Silence, in a way.
Feed Them Silence was great. Oh my God,
right?
You're right. I read a Butch main character story and loved it. Lee Mandello is doing it.
There you go.
I guess.
There you go. As far as can we fix it here, Paris, I mean, again, it's hard for me to say. I get that all the weird vignettes influence how Mike sees herself and impact the little speech she gives at what Butch is at the end, but she moves on from each one so fast that I feel like I don't get the cascading impact upon her identity and personality that each scene could have. If there was a little bit more reflecting on how all of her relationships affected her or end up or anything else, I could have been more interesting. Is really my bottom line. Could have been more interesting.
Yeah. You know what? I realized we never read the passage in Butch at the end where she's like, this is what Butch is.
Well, here you go.
Do that. A Butch is someone no one understands and no one can explain, she said. She thought about answering better, but she wasn't sure anyone could really truthfully say. Some people think she's mannish, but she really isn't, and being like a man is the furthest thing from her mind. Some people think it's a role that you play, like acting, pretending to be what a man might be in a relationship with a woman. But it's not acting or playing or a role. It's being a kid and old at the same time. It's loving women with a part of you no man will ever discover and other women will never find. It's not even really being a dyke or queer or a lesbian. Femmes are those things. It's being a feminist without needing a definition or an analysis. It's loving women without needing to be told how. It's having control when you really don't, and being tough when you really aren't, and giving love when you really can't, and surviving in a world that doesn't want you to, and dressing so men don't mistake you for prey, and walking in a way that keeps you alive. So, I think what strikes me is that academic paper I read and this book kind of come to the same conclusion at the end, which is kind of like...
But I don't know how... The author got there from what was presented.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We don't get any of the, you know, we don't know what's in the sausage. We just get the finished product, you know, in a little package at the end. And it's sort of like, man, I wanted to see what was going on in your mind. And I'm not getting any of that. In terms of what we could fix. Yeah, I think this could totally be fixed. If we just spent more time with Mike's more important relationships. I think we'd get further, you know, if we could skip over maybe like Priscilla, the lady who like pissed in front of her and then had her chained her to a bed, and then, oh no, Priscilla was cheating on her girlfriend with Mike. Like, that story didn't lend anything to the book, right? Mm-hmm. There were quite a few of those where I'm like, well, I don't think Mike learned anything from this. And so many scenarios were confusing or absurd. If this was tamped down a bit, it'd be a lot better. Again, the writing does really leave you wanting for richness for much of the book. So it could also use some, you know, thesaurus and like descriptive writing work. And I, you know, in thinking about it, I think this would be a lot better as like a film. Because it could be way more effective if you're watching someone go through these things and like their facial expression and like how they're interacting with someone. It just seems like this might perhaps be the wrong form of media for this kind of thing. You know, not that it's any easier to get a fucking movie made. Yeah. It's harder, but yeah, I just think that this might be a better thing to show visually. I don't know.
Sure.
Anyway.
All right.
Thank you to Tris for consulting with us on this and giving us some thoughts and opinions from her life. And thank you, Chris, for going on this this weird one.
Appreciate
journey
that
with me.
Thank you to the patrons for supporting this show. Thank you to the Bad Bookworms, Emily, Ben, Bleached Black Cat, Renee, Scott H, Donnie, Anya, Lycoris, Jakub, Jared, and Will. The Exacting Editors, Rudy Bobooty, The Ugly One, Emmy, Harry Seven, Funny Robot with Antennas, David, Martin, Kieran, Elliot, Dee, and Craig. The Loathsome Librarians of the Void, The Taco Eating Unicorn, Robin, Beast with the Least, Austin, Patricia, Veronica, Lucek, Tina, and Arant. The Pesky Publishers, Julius the Nice Dragon, and Miles May, and of course our Ko-fi donor, Kiwi Thing. Will anyone accept the challenge to become our arch-archivist this year? What huge, enormous, monstrous tome will you force us to read with said privileges?
I kind of don't want it to happen.
Yeah, actually,
but
don't take
at the
that.
Same time,
but you know, money can make us do things.
Yeah, that's how that works.
All right, Paris.
Well, it's another episode where we read a book that was very much not for us. We are not the intended audience of this book.
Yep, that's.
But we lived to tell the tale. I am more awake than I was before.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Which is
I hope
a bad
I can get to
thing,
bed.
I
that would be very bad because I already am working off 3 hours of sleep from the previous night, so I better be able to sleep again, is what I'm saying. I hope.
Wait, why did you only get 3 hours of sleep?
I just had an insomnia bout. It just happens sometimes.
Oh, you know, it was the Hardy Boys.
That's
thinking
probably
too
it.
Much about those mysteries.
Yeah, so, you know, you come along with us for a chaotic season 9 and fuck you, Scribondo. See you later.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Terrible Book Club. Terrible Book Club is an independent podcast produced by your hosts, Paris and Chris. Sound design and audio editing by Chris, with sound effects and music by Epidemic Sound and sometimes also Chris. Our theme song is Kiss by Yearn, which is, you guessed it, actually, also Chris. You can find more of his soothing synthy sounds on Bandcamp at yearn.bandcamp.com. Do you want us to review a book of your choice on the show? Do you want access to some extra audiovisual weirdness? If so, become a patron at patreon.com/terriblebookclub. If you'd like to send us a one-time tip instead, you can do that at ko-fi.com/terriblebookclub. You can also support TBC for free by sharing the show on social media, following our accounts on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Goodreads, telling your friends about your favorite episode, or by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or anywhere else on the internet. To send us book recommendations or your adorable pet photos, send an email to terriblebookclub@gmail.com.
I was wondering if that was going to happen, and it did. I feel like now we have to spin out the lore of Scribondo and his universe. Like, Who's Scribondo's, like, helper? Like, who's this fucking Iago parrot? Oh, Baginski asterisk!